Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
As Rhode Island's first ever member-owned credit union, Navigant Credit Union has been a staple in the local business community for more than 108 years. Today, Navigant is a $3.4 billion institution serving more than 136,000 members across 25 physical branch locations. But since its founding in 1915, the mission has never changed. Navigant Credit Union's team of financial professionals have remained committed to improving the financial well-being of the families, businesses, and communities they serve across Rhode Island. Learn more at NavigantCU.org.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.
Michael Kamal is a URI grad and someone who's working for the Department of Homeland Security. And I won't bury the lead here because I think that this is a really provocative statement that exists in the bio that I was sent. Through law enforcement cases and survivor testimonials, Kamal's team found that many victims of human trafficking used commercial and private air while the exploitation occurred. Under Kamal's leadership, the program now includes several New England-based airports, including Rhode Island T.F. Greene International Airport. Michael, thanks so much for making the time this morning. This is obviously a major issue. It's a heavy issue. And through your forensic expertise, you've been able to assess it from a really important standpoint. So again, thanks for the time and appreciate it.
Thank you, Bill, so much for having me on.
What got you into this work to begin with?
Well, believe it or not, it actually started with a federal internship with the Department of Homeland Security in the biometrics office. That led to my first full-time federal job with the Anti-Human Trafficking Division at Homeland Security. And I didn't think I would be here for that long. But once you start working on human trafficking and you start to speak with survivors of human trafficking who have been through it, but now they're out of it, it's really motivating and it makes you want to do more and contribute to a mission that really matters.
It's a crazy mission as well, because it's one that is so, sometimes so difficult to spot and so difficult to understand the full spectrum of just how deep this crisis really runs. Your quick takeaway before we get into the details of how big of a problem is human trafficking right now?
It's an incredibly big problem. And unfortunately, it's not a new problem either. This has been going on for pretty much since the U.S. was a country, even before that. It just looks a little bit different in different forms. 24 years ago, there was not a federal law that defined what human trafficking was, but it was still occurring. The International Labor Organization estimates that there are 27 million victims globally. If you look at the National Human Trafficking Hotline data, that's just the United States, you're looking at thousands of cases, tens of thousands of victims. And from the data that I looked at, about 50% of those were U.S. citizens and 50% foreign nationals. So that's not something people normally think about. And it happens also, I'll say, in every single U.S. state and territory in every country around the world. So there's a mindset, I know I had it at one point, where I thought this couldn't happen in my community, but it definitely can, and most likely it probably has.
What are some of the key figures, metrics right now? You just ticked off a few right there, but just to kind of paint a picture of, let's say, in New England or in the Northeast, are there any hot spots? Is there an area that just seems to be quote unquote ground zero for this, or is the problem so widespread that there really is no epicenter when it comes to the crisis?
That's a great question. I get that question a lot about hotspots for human trafficking, and I got to be cautious answering that because when you look at the big cities, the places where they're doing a lot of awareness work, where they've got a lot of law enforcement, you're going to see more cases generally. But what you also see is cases in those rural areas, places you wouldn't think of. There was a recent case in Boston involving a pizza parlor that was trafficking migrants. People were going to that pizza parlor. They didn't know that the workers were being trafficked. Things like that. There was also a recent case out of Woonsocket, Rhode Island. This man, Ronald Hall, he was exploiting about 5 females into sex trafficking, having them work commercial sex acts in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Nevada, Florida. And he was using drugs as a means to keep them in that situation. One of those victims overdosed and died, and it resulted in an investigation. Thankfully, Homeland Security Investigations was able to help the victims, put that trafficker in jail for 18 years. And that one is a success story because the trafficker was held accountable. When I think about it, I think Woonsocket, that's such a random town. I did an internship at the post office in Woonsocket. I never would have thought that there was human trafficking going on there. So when we do our awareness, we focus on the major cities where we know there's a lot of travel, we know there's a lot of people, but we also don't want to forget about those rural towns and the small states that are sometimes overlooked.
What's the average age of someone who is a victim of human trafficking?
Well, the data that you're looking at is a little bit limited because it doesn't account for the people who go unnoticed, who go unreported. But if you look at the data, the National Human Trafficking Hotline, you're going to see a diverse set of victims, young, old. You're also going to see different stats for sex trafficking and labor trafficking. Both of those are considered human trafficking. With sex trafficking, you're looking at mostly minors between the age of 13 and 17, sometimes younger, sometimes older. With labor trafficking, you're looking at a little bit older of an age demographic and typically more foreign nationals than U.S. citizens, but it certainly can happen either way.
Your work has extended to the international level, of course, that naturally would be the case. I see an image here of you speaking to Brazilian law enforcement over the summer. What sort of relationship does the Department of Homeland Security have with other agencies around the world, whether it's Brazil or any other country for that matter? Is there cooperation in this space in terms of it being an international front against human trafficking?
Yes, there's a lot of cooperation that goes on between Homeland Security, between the federal government in general, and the international community, because we know that this crime doesn't just happen within the U.S. borders. It can also go internationally to every single country. And so with my program, Blue Lightning Initiative, we partner with the U.S. airlines and airports, but we got approval now to partner with foreign airlines and airports as well. So we can provide them with training, help them build up their anti-trafficking programs. And then our office will also train foreign law enforcement so that they know how to use a victim-centered approach and so that they can better assist victims and target traffickers. In foreign countries, they have different resources. But in Brazil, we went to Brazil. We did a training at the Sao Paulo airport. And then I went to Recife and did some training for the law enforcement there. And then we ended up securing an official partnership with a Brazilian airline union. That was the first foreign airline union that we partnered with. And we're looking to partner with many more. So it expands to foreign law enforcement as well as a foreign private sector. We just want to make sure that everyone's communicating and that everyone is aware of human trafficking.
And then kind of similarly going in the inverse direction, what about the local police departments that, especially in those rural towns, sometimes they're the eyes and ears on the ground? What relationship does Department of Homeland Security have local law enforcement?
The great thing about Homeland Security is that we have a presence in every single state, and our investigative authority expands internationally. So these local departments, if they encounter a foreign national victim of human trafficking, they can always reach out to Homeland Security for assistance. The other great thing is that Homeland Security has task force officers, which are local law enforcement officers that are deputized to work on federal cases. And they work on task forces. There's task forces throughout the entire country. And these agencies are working together. I will say that there is definitely a lack of knowledge among some of those local departments. So one of our big initiatives is to train the local, the rural departments, so that they, first step, know what human trafficking is. And then number two, know how to address it in a victim-centered and trauma-informed way that's going to give the best chance at assisting the victim and putting that trafficker in jail.
Really, from taking a look at this issue, just even on a glance level, it's clear that aviation is a major piece of this entire saga, this entire crisis. And I wonder, from your standpoint, do the airlines in the private sector context, are they doing enough right now to combat trafficking?
They're doing quite a lot. But if you ask me, there's always more that can be done. Aviation is huge because it's a controlled environment. Also transportation too. So we're doing partnerships with the aviation industry, with the ground transportation. We just announced a partnership with Lyft. And in the near future, we've got an announcement coming with the cruise lines. It's a whole of private industry approach. It's not one company's fault that this stuff is happening under our watch, but it is all of our responsibility to do something about it. And the one thing I will add just before I wrap up on that is that human trafficking is a crime of exploitation. So it can involve movement, and it has obviously in the case I just talked about with Rhode Island. But there are also cases where there's no movement required at all, where someone is being exploited within their own community, sometimes by family members or people that they know, maybe within their own home. And that's a case that still counts as human trafficking. So that's another thing to consider, is that it does involve movement, it can, but also it could be happening within one's own home.
What a heavy lift for someone to take on, obviously the work itself, but also how has this impacted your view of the world? Seeing, you know, you talk to folks who have firsthand experience in any type of traumatic space, whether that's physicians, fire officials, police, law enforcement, you name it. And it's hard to find somebody who hasn't been personally impacted by the work. How has this shaped your worldview?
Well, I feel like if you ask most people that question, or the answer people would probably think is that it brought my view of the world down and that look at how terrible people can be. But it's actually the opposite. I feel empowered to work on anti-trafficking. And I get asked about victims, you know, what is the main quality that you see in former victims that are now survivors? And the first thing that comes to my mind is resilience, leadership, and strength. Because in order for those survivors to get out of that situation, they need to be strong. Most of the time, it's not a law enforcement officer physically pulling them out of that situation, although that can happen. Most of the time, the survivors need to get out on their own decision. And we need to be there to provide the resources so that they can leave and that they don't have to go back to their trafficker. You know, working with the survivors, that's empowering, and it motivates me to do what I do. And yes, it can be sad to see some of these things, but it's also empowering to see all the people that are so passionate about this issue and that are working to make sure that other people don't have to go through the same thing that they did.
There's been, over the last several years, in some corners of politics, really, there's been distrust towards federal law enforcement. It's been, you know, suggested even the most wild theories that, you know, it's one big deep state type of operation, things of this sort. Not even going there. Right now, what's it like working in federal law enforcement in 2024 in a moment where there's levels of instability in this country that, on the one hand, are pretty dialed in? On the other hand, you know, it's kind of crazy right now out there.
It is. And it's about cutting through the noise. And so working in a federal law enforcement agency, I see the cases that come out, the great work that's done by the agents, by the CBP officers. It's about putting those stories in the spotlight. I would invite whoever the biggest conspiracy theorist is to come on your podcast and take a look at the list of cases that Homeland Security did in just the last month. It would be hard to look at those cases and say, this is not amazing work. I mean, these agents are recovering child victims of exploitation, human trafficking, child sex tourism, almost every single day. They're combating terrorism. They're recovering artifacts that are stolen from overseas. This type of work often gets brushed under the rug, but it's incredible work. And I try to do my best to highlight those stories because it also motivates people to want to join the federal government. And it's not just some, you know, deep state. There's a lot of people who are working to do really good work on this issue and many others.
What does it take to become a federal agent?
Well, there's, so I'm a program manager, so I'm not a federal agent, but in order to become a agent, you need to apply on USA Jobs to the announcement. You have to go to a federal law enforcement training center for a few months. You need to pass a security clearance, test, so to speak. And then you begin your work and you work on cases. And each federal law enforcement agency is a little bit different. Homeland Security Investigations is very broad, but you also have other agencies such as the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the FBI, the DEA, working on different mission sets depending on what you're interested in.
You're set to speak at URI. Both of our, we're both alums of the University of Rhode Island. Full disclosure, the University of Rhode Island is their online program is a sponsor of this podcast. This isn't brokered content or anything. We actually were really excited about this story. This is, this is an authentic pursuit, but I also use this as a chance to shout out URI and the great education that I got there. You're going to be speaking at the Forensic Science Seminar Series coming up later this year. Talk about your experience at URI, if you could, and how it prepared you for the work you're doing right now.
The University of Rhode Island is such a great place. I'm from New Jersey, like many URI alum, and had it not been for my URI connections, I wouldn't have started my career at Homeland Security. I had a writing professor my first year who I told them I was interested in working for the federal government because I watched some TV shows that showed agents doing cool stuff. And she had went out of her way and said, "Oh, my husband works at Homeland Security in Boston. Let me hook you up with an informational interview." And she went above and beyond, and she connected me to her husband, and I ended up doing a job shadow of his office at the Homeland Security office in Boston for just one day. And there it just sparked, that was my freshman year. This was back in 2014. It sparked my interest in the Homeland Security mission. I got to see the cameras that they used, the protocols that were in place in case a terrorist attack happened. And then this was also shortly after the, a few months after the Boston Marathon bombing. And so he was telling me all the steps, all the things that went into place to catch those terrorists and to, document the evidence, make sure that it didn't happen again. And that thing just made me interested in the overall Homeland Security mission. It made me want to work at Homeland Security. And it was just something that my professor went out of their way to do. She didn't have to do that, but she did. And had it not been for that, I don't think I would be here today. So URI, it was the connection, and the education was also excellent. I also did several internships while I was an undergrad that led to this job here.
Kind of wrapping up, just going back to the topic at hand here, human trafficking. If someone is hearing this right now and they have, for whatever reason, they have their instinct, they have information that suggests that they know someone, they know of a scenario where human trafficking is taking place, what are the steps that they should take? Should they contact local law enforcement, go directly to Homeland Security? How do you do that anonymously? And sometimes, it's a fine line because you don't want to be judgmental and say, "Oh, this person is engaged in or a victim of human trafficking just on a whim." So how do you effectively suss that out and make sure that the right enforcement agency knows about it and is able to pursue it if need be?
Great question. So I'm going to simplify this. There are three main reporting options for human trafficking. Number one, we always have 911 as an option. I would say this is the best option if you are 100% confirmed it's human trafficking. Maybe you have someone that came up to you and said, "I'm a victim, I need some help." 911, they're going to be there the fastest. The second number is a Homeland Security Investigations tip line number. This number is used if you suspect human trafficking, but you're not quite sure. You don't need to do anything, interview them or anything like that. We're just ask you to call that number and tell us why you feel it's suspicious. Look up the indicators, tell us what indicators you see. That number is 1-866-347-2423. The third number is the national hotline number. This is a number for victims to get support. If you know a victim, they can get support. Many of the adult victims, they have a fear of law enforcement, so they just want to get non-governmental support before they talk to law enforcement if they do. And that number is the perfect one for that. So that's 1-888-373-7888. So those are the three options, and I hope that helps everyone.
Michael, incredible work. Congratulations on your efforts. Congratulations on, you know, just sort of being a great success story out of the University of Rhode Island and hence Rhode Island. And best of luck as you move forward. This is such important work that is, again, people know about it, people talk about it, but it hasn't risen to the level of awareness that, as you describe, happens in even rural communities. It's a tragedy, and your work is just, it's thankless, but we are thankful for it.
Well, thank you for spotlighting this issue and inviting me to speak. Thank you.
For daily content, follow Bartholomew Town on Instagram and TikTok.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.